Welcome back to the broadcast. This is the third hour of the day for Thursday, the 30th of June, 2005. I'm Chris Gerner. It continues to be a deceptive direction that we live today. I'm honored to have with me David Stahl from Corridor Watch, as Darren has engineered this. And David, welcome to the broadcast.
Good evening. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much. And certainly you've spent a lot of time on your website, CorridorWatch.org, which is on our NAFTA Corridor site, listeners. That's CorridorWatch.com. It's at the bottom. Where did it all start for you, David?
Well, it started a couple of years ago when my wife first caught word of the Trans-Texas Corridor. And we live in rural Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just concerned about the size and scope of a road project that would be coming perhaps to our area. That was the initial contact, and frankly, it started off with us as a not-in-my-backyard issue. But quickly, it evolved into being something much more sinister than just another large road project. At the time, I was city manager of the city of Columbus, Texas, which is located on an interstate highway. And Columbus, a population about 4,000. And the road impact that the interstate has on the city of Columbus is tremendous. The city's revenue stream, there's twice as much sales tax as there is property tax citywide. And if you were to draw a circle around the interchange of 10 and the on-ramps and off-ramps, only 1,500 feet, 80% of all that sales tax revenue was generated there. And so what got me interested was, here's a parallel road project that by design does not go to any cities in Texas, not even the largest cities. It bypasses all of the cities and existing commerce far enough away so as not to have free highways compete with it, because it's going to be a toll project. And if it were successful in pulling traffic off of the existing interstate system, it would have a significant detrimental impact to communities like Columbus. If we lost 25% of our sales tax revenue that the highway generated, that would require a 50% property tax increase. And there isn't any community in Texas that could survive a 50% tax increase. And so we would find our community and thousands of others going the way of those that were along Route 66. And that was the genesis that got me involved. But once I did get involved and started looking at the document that created and proposed this corridor, I was shocked and appalled. I've been involved in local government for 25 years. I'm third-generation public servant. And I found a document that describes a government operation that isn't how our government is supposed to operate. It was conceived not out of being a transportation project, but out of being a revenue generation project. It didn't come out of the highway department. It didn't come out of one of the state's transportation institutes. It came out of the governor's office. And when it was pitched to the legislators, the first point they made was that this would generate revenue, albeit revenue for transportation. That's true, but generate revenue. And the way it generates revenue is by creating a complete separate economic power in the state that feeds money to the state and takes it away from communities and from existing infrastructure, business infrastructure. And that was very troubling. The only thing that gave us any comfort was that there was in this plan that had already at that point been officially adopted without any public input, any discussion, any debate. This plan that had been adopted had page after page of required legislative changes. And we were assured by our local legislators that there was no way that they'd make such sweeping changes of law and hand over such broad power to an appointed board, being the Transportation Commission. A year later, after we stopped paying attention, we discovered that a House bill had indeed passed, and it was a transportation bill. And it passed during a session when we had legislators going off to Arizona and New Mexico because of redistricting issues. Everybody had their eye on redistricting, and nobody paid any attention to this 300-and-something page bill that passed that created the Trans-Texas Corridor. That bill had in it every single thing they asked for in the original plan, and it's incredible. It expands the ability to take private land. It allows them to take your land instantly, which is to say, they call it quick take. They can serve you with the papers, and when they take that paper back and file it at the courthouse, they can immediately move on to your land. It's no longer yours. The only thing you have to debate is what you get paid for it, but the work goes on. If it's homesteaded, if you're unfortunate enough to have it be your home, they do have to wait to the 91st day. But there's no discussion. 91st day, you're out of there, and they move in. Those things were the tip of the iceberg. It allows the state to create economic monopolies, ancillary facilities, take unlimited land adjacent to this corridor that's already a quarter mile wide, and develop any kind of commercial enterprise on it through a private partner whose agreement is negotiated in secret, and the state has in fact already selected their first partner, and it's a firm from Madrid, Spain, not even an American firm.
Right.
That's not an accident. The Texas Department of Transportation had its most expensive field trip in history when it sent the director of their Turnpike Authority on a whistle-stop tour of Europe, and one of his stops was Madrid, Spain. And when they had the first public hearings happening here in Texas to theoretically tell people about the Trans-Texas Corridor, at that very time, during the exact same time, they had the Spanish-American Chamber of Commerce here touring the state, showing them where they can build the corridors. So this is a massive international undertaking that was done under the radar, without public input, without public knowledge, without a basis in transportation need. There's not one traffic count, one traffic study that's used as a basis to justify this. It's been now 2 years, and they still haven't come up with any traffic justification. Even the NAFTA traffic doesn't justify it. NAFTA traffic in Texas has been flat. There's been no significant increase since 2000. That's 5 years. The reason it's flat is because it was predicated on all this manufacturing growth that was going to happen in the state of Chihuahua in Mexico. The fact of the matter is the world economy has changed, and that manufacturing has now shifted to China. And so they've not had that explosive growth. And yet people are committed to this as a NAFTA corridor that's going to run clear across the country, and they're using numbers that they intentionally make sure always reach back well before 1999 so that they pick up the big numbers and make it appear that there is a continuing growth and we need to have this highway, when in fact we don't.
Do you think this land closure being okayed by the Supreme Court, where they can allow local governments to take your property, do you think this interconnects with this?
Absolutely. We had been following the Kello versus New London case for 2 years. We had really hoped that, we frankly just suspected the Supreme Court would do the right thing. Who would have thought they would reverse 150 years of Supreme Court precedents and say that the government can seize your land just because they think somebody will do something more productive with it? That was a complete shock. The only good news there is it was a split court. It would have been even more depressing if more than five justices felt that way. It was a real blow to us. But yes, it greases the wheels. It says, yes, taking land away from Texans that have had it for 100 years in their family and giving it through the state to a Spanish consortium to operate all manner of commercial enterprise and export that money not only out of the community but the state and the country is okay. That you can do that. We think that's absolutely wrong. I suppose the good news is the Supreme Court just interprets law, and we do have the ability through the legislature, both the federal and state, to address that and get some changes. I know here in Texas there's already a move afoot to change the Texas Constitution to restrict that kind of taking. I know that John Cornyn, a senator also from Texas, has introduced a legislation in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate, to also restrict that type of taking where there's any federal, by the federal government or where any federal money is involved. So we're hoping that that's the silver lining, that the Supreme Court has shocked people into seeing what direction this country is taking and making a course correction before it's too late.
Now, do you think that this latest ruling is waking a lot of people up in this country to their concerns?
I think it certainly has. I think that there were a lot of private property groups out there that were like-minded with us that suspected that this was going to be a good opportunity to clarify that you can't take someone's property and give it to some commercial enterprise just because you think it'll generate more taxes. They're outraged. They're properly outraged. They should be. I think that those who weren't paying any attention to property rights are equally outraged. To say that you can't hold on to your land and use it for whatever use you want because the government thinks somebody else will do something better with it is absurd. It flies in the face of what this country was founded on, and I think now it gives us an opportunity to set that right.
Now, it appears that Supreme Court Justice Ron Strom is about to lose his property, according to WorldNet Daily. Do you know about that?
Yeah, there has been some battle going on there for a while.
I wonder what is going to be the end result of that with his situation, and whether he'll... I'm sure he voted probably to not allow this to happen. I'm sure he was a yes or a no vote on this.
Frankly, I don't have that in front of me.
I don't either.
I know that if you read the dissenting opinion of Sandra Day O'Connor, it's extremely strong. Actually, it's one of the strongest dissenting opinions I've read in a long time. She doesn't mince any words and basically says that, you know, if the government thinks that a Motel 6 would be better on your property than what you're doing with it, then they can take it. She's really telling it the way it is. People need to read those decisions. And Clarence Thomas, likewise, with his own dissenting opinion, a little different perspective on it, but also dissenting. But people should read what Sandra Day O'Connor has to say, the justice. She really hits the nail on the head, and I think that's right. I think it will resonate with people across the country.
We have Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who flatly these individuals that voted to allow this to happen, they don't have our Constitution in mind, do they?
No, they certainly don't. As a matter of fact, it's pretty clear that they're ignoring, for whatever reason, they've got blinders on and aren't looking at it the way I believe it was intended. I think it's very clear. And that is, in fact, what Clarence Thomas points out in his dissenting opinion. And I find it fascinating, the world of Supreme Court justices, you know, they live in a different environment than we do. And I found it kind of enlightening to see that as they research their cases and they reach their decisions, they actually use dictionaries of the period in which the Constitution was written, which makes perfect sense. And so he puts it in context of what public use meant when the Bill of Rights were written. And in that context, it's pretty clear that they're not looking at what public use meant when the Bill of Rights were written, that they're now trying to twist that into some modern-day version.
Have you had... meetings in your community about this corridor at all in the past? Have you been a party to any of meetings of people getting together to talk about this?
Absolutely. Little more than a year ago, they had the first public hearing, and my wife and I visited with the local Lions Club and Rotary, and the law required, you know, this is a matter of perspective, and it shows you, I think, bad intent. The law said that before the corridor alignment could be put through a county, that the Texas Department of Transportation had to hold at least one meeting in that county, a public hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that wording was changed. Originally it said one meeting, and they changed it to at least one meeting. And there isn't any attorney that won't tell you that if you say at least one meeting, it only means one meeting. And so they were required to hold that meeting. Well, before this plan was fully unrolled for the public, they held a blitzkrieg of 254 public meetings in 28 days. Now, there's 254 counties in Texas, and only with the massive plan of 4,000 miles of corridor, only about 118 counties would ever see the corridor, and yet our Department of Transportation held 254 meetings, as many as 32 in one day, to cover every county and have met that statutory requirement so they never have to go back and hold another public hearing. And they did that at a point when nobody knew anything about it, didn't know what it was. They got to see a glossed-over videotape and a six-page handout, two pages of which were just fluff and two pages of bullet point things and a survey question. It was absolutely a joke. Now, when we went to our local county in Colorado County, Texas, where Columbus is located, to that meeting, because my wife went to the Rotary and Lions Club, she managed to get about 20 people there. And the TxDOT person that was giving that presentation was shocked because he had done a couple of them, and the one he did the night before was pretty typical in Austin County. There were five people in attendance. These meetings were so poorly publicized and attended, it was incredible. We read reports of one in West Texas where to get the story in the newspaper, only two people attended, and they both were newspaper reporters, so they interviewed each other. Our meeting of having 20 was unheard of. The next week, there was going to be a meeting in the county we live in, Fayette County, and they wanted to know if we were coming to that meeting, which, of course, we were. Instead of the person who was scheduled to hold that meeting, the district engineer came himself from Yoakum, Texas, and he met myself and my wife at the door as we arrived. He had people out in the parking lot because the parking lot was completely overrun, and they had to park people in the yard, at the service yard at the TxDOT building where the meeting was being held. And he said that there was two things he wanted to tell me. One, there'd be no questions and answers.
Wow.
Now, how's that for a public hearing?
Slap in the face.
There'd be no questions and answers. And the public statement that you were allowed to make in the public hearing, that myself and my wife and everyone we brought with us would be held to the three-minute limit together, and we could divide that time any way we wanted.
What a slap in the face.
So we told Lonnie, who I had known and worked with in my official government capacity, I told Lonnie, I said, you know, Lonnie, my wife and I are here together, and we'll split our time. But all these other people here are Texans, and I imagine they can stand up and speak for themselves. And the meeting went on, and we went through the dog and pony show. And they had a room that would hold about 60 people, and there were 80 people there, so the hall was packed, and there were people out in the lobby of the building that couldn't even see the presentation, the meeting. And one of the people who was in the room and standing, because it was standing room only, was our county judge, Judge Ed Janechka. And Judge Janechka listened to this for about an hour, and then he stopped the district engineer, and he said, you know what, this doesn't count as a public hearing for my county. He said, you don't come and hold this kind of meeting, which, by the way, they did at 7 o'clock on Ash Wednesday. Ash Wednesday in a predominantly Catholic and Lutheran community where most of the people are in church at that very time. So this isn't going to count. You need to come back and do this again, and I'll find you a building that you can fit enough people in. But I think we need to have this at the hall because a lot of people are interested. You know, Fayette County is the only county that got a second meeting. They came back for the second meeting, and instead of bringing the district engineer, they brought the executive director of the state transportation department, and they brought one of the transportation commissioners. And their meeting was held at a hall in LaGrange, Texas, and there were 800 people in attendance.
Wonderful.
800 unhappy people. There were about 20 TxDOT people there, and it was at times nearly a free-for-all. There were no answers. they spent a lot of time telling people that they didn't know this or that hadn't been decided yet. It was all conceptual, and that the first thing that would have to happen would be environmental meetings, and there weren't any even scheduled, and so none of this was going to happen for years. Well, that was fascinating, because 2 weeks from that day, TxDOT announced the first round of environmental meetings for TTC 69, which is the NAFTA corridor. And I find it very difficult to believe that the executive director of the State Transportation Department didn't know that in 2 weeks they would start a round of environmental hearings. So, you know, and those hearings are only being held because it's the law, it's the federal law, it's NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, that requires them to hold those meetings. Or I'm certain that they would have held all of them in one day and said they were done with that as well.
You've, you know, your website is very extensive. I'm just amazed that it took so long for us to find it. You talk about Trans-Texas Corridor versus Interstate Highway, and you say, what is the difference? Are you able to explain what the difference between the two highways are?
Absolutely. If someone will click on that box on our website, we have a document. Matter of fact, we even make it available on a PDF so you can print it yourself and distribute it. This is not an interstate highway. This is not a super interstate highway. This is not a turnpike. I've traveled extensively, and I've been on the Ohio Turnpike and the Pennsylvania Turnpike and the Garden State Turnpike, and this is nothing like any of those. This is designed to be vehicle lanes in four sets, two sets of truck lanes, two sets of vehicle lanes, six rail lines, which includes conventional rail, high-speed freight rail, high-speed passenger rail. It includes 200 feet of width for underground and overhead utilities. It includes an additional 400-plus feet that's not designated for anything, that is just reserved out space. So it's nearly a quarter mile wide. This road goes from nowhere to nowhere. It goes outside all the major cities. Now, theoretically, they'll tell you that is to bypass those cities to reduce congestion.
Yes.
But the reality is that those cities are the congestion generators. They're the destination points. They're the departure points. And so they're always going to have that traffic. It's the people in those cities that create that traffic. You know, you can drive through Dallas or Houston or San Antonio, and you can do it on a Saturday, and you can do it in the middle of the night, and you can do it. You can even do it at 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and there's not very much traffic. This is drive-time traffic. You know, and truck drivers are smart. They know when to stay away from a city if it conflicts with their schedule, and they don't go through during drive time unless they have to. And there are loops around cities. There's loops around Houston. As a matter of fact, Interstate 10 that goes through Houston east and west drops down to only two lanes in each direction, not because of construction, because they've never built it any bigger than that. You know, as you approach Houston, you go from two lanes to three lanes to four lanes, and portions of it in town are five lanes wide. If they're concerned with through traffic, why is it necked down to just two lanes before you get through the city? And, of course, there are loops. There's 610, and there's now Beltway 8 around Houston. And do you think trucks, when they get to Houston, take one of those loops to avoid the traffic going through town? No, they don't. Partially because 8 is a toll road, certainly available to trucks. And yet, you could count on your thumbs the number of 18-wheelers you would see if you drove all the way around Beltway 8 at any given time of day or night.
You know, this is very fascinating, and your research is superlative. You have two tracks for 200 mile per hour high speed passenger rail. 200 mile per hour high speed passenger rail. When you connect all these dots to this, and then you have 80 mile per hour commuter passenger rail as well, and 80 mile per hour freight rail, you have six railroad tracks, don't you?
That's correct.
Now, with this, the way it is in plan and in the direction it's going, every state has to comply with this direction, otherwise it's dead.
Well, it's kind of interesting because when they launched this, they gave a map and they gave the priority corridors. And the priority corridors ran from Louisiana to New Mexico, from Mexico to Oklahoma. Those were the major corridors. And when they launched this, they had already had discussions with, and as a matter of fact, the original plan showed all the corridor connections all the way to southern Mexico. But it didn't show one inch of the corridor extending into New Mexico, Oklahoma, or Louisiana. And as a matter of fact, they had never even had a discussion with the transportation officials from any of those three states. But we had had several discussions with Mexico. which is very interesting, very telling.
Yes.
You know, so
what was their read on this whole thing?
Well, their read was that they'll build this portion here, and those other states will come along. As you know, I-69, which is dubbed the NAFTA corridor, runs all the way to Canada, and they're building portions of it. But you know, that's an interstate. That's not a 1,200 foot wide mega highway. That's not something that is going to be concessioned out. You know, the state of Texas isn't going to operate this. This is all a concession project. They're going to turn the keys over for 50 to 70 years. You know, that's half a century.
Yes.
They're going to turn that over to a concession operator, and that concession operator will have absolute say over all the tolls, fees, and leases. We're not just talking about tolls for cars and trucks, but we're talking about the rail that goes on it, the utilities that go under it and over it, and all of the land that's associated with it. Some concessionaire. There may be multiple concessionaires. I'm sure there will be. So they're not all necessarily Centra from Spain. But we're turning over public infrastructure to private entities, large corporate private entities, and they're going to suck the economy out of Texas, out of communities, even Dallas. The city of Dallas is a participant in an organization called River of Trade Coalition. And the River Trade Corridor Coalition is concerned that the Trans-Texas Corridor is going to route all of the truck traffic around Dallas. See, that truck traffic, that's money. When you talk about commercial real estate, it's location first, then it's location second, and it's location third. And one of the things they look at for anything that's retail is traffic counts. You start moving the traffic, what they call the river of trade, you move that out of communities as large as Dallas, and you're taking dollars with it. And they're going to go out here and they're going to locate on this new corridor, and all the frontage is going to be controlled by the concessionaire. See, because unlike an interstate, there is no access. It's a closed access corridor. So if you want to do development on it and you own the real estate next to it, you can't do the development, but the concessionaire can. So the state's private partner can. And, you know, they say this is an innovative project. Well, I'd like them to show me what's innovative about rails and roads, because we've been doing those for more than 100 years here.
Well, yeah, and this is the unfortunate part about the situation. You have this Kansas City Southern Railroad. It's a holding company which comprises of four railroads: Kansas City Southern Railway Company, the Texas Mexican Railway Company, Tex-Mex, TFM, the Panama Canal Railway Company, and together these railroads are known as the NAFTA Railway. And yet most of our business and industry has gone to communist China. Are they planning on bringing it back? I mean, what is the reasoning behind all this when we see so much going on around us today that doesn't make much sense, especially the Middle East mess that we're involved in? And yet they're making this mega plan, a public-private partnership, to engineer this. It's just something that at this stage doesn't make any sense. We're going to take a break. Listeners, we're with, once again, David Stahl. CorridorWatch.com is the website, and they're on our website, American Exposé, in the NAFTA Corridor section. Go there now if you're not already there, listeners. Much to do. If you have any questions, you can email me, or you can call in at 559-781-3773, 559-781-3773. We will return momentarily.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated radio stations.
America is at war right now. It's not a war against Iraq, nor is it a war against terrorism. It's a new war for our independence. At stake is our Constitution and the very freedoms we enjoy every day. You see, power-hungry politicians are quietly advancing something deceptively named the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA. Proponents claim they are merely promoting trade by turning North and South America into a huge economic union. But in reality, it's a brazen scheme to eliminate the authority of the U.S. government, submitting our nation to the whims of a new regional superpower. America as we value it will steadily disappear, as will our rights, our Constitution, and our freedoms. Help win the war against the FTAA. Go to stoptheftaa.org and help keep America free. That's stoptheftaa.org.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at firstamendmentradio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25, or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at firstamendmentradio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on firstamendmentradio.com are listener-supported. Don't do internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at firstamendmentradio.com.
Back with David Stahl, listeners. CorridorWatch.com is the website. I see here, David, from TEA 21, that's the Transportation Equity Act for the 21st Century. On May 9th, the Senate will resume work on its safety plan, that's SAFTE-TEA, legislation that renews the nation's surface transportation law for TEA 21 through fiscal year 2009. Our legislators are being directed to do this. I'm sure it's because the federal government will withhold federal money to the states if they do not comply with this. What are your thoughts?
Well, there's certainly a lot of support coming from the federal government for this Trans-Texas Corridor. I know that every time a major announcement is made, Mary Peters, who's the administrator of the Federal Highway Administration, magically appears in Austin, Texas. And they are doing things that have not been done with projects anywhere before, one of which is called SEP 14. It's a special exception policy that allows them to start construction before the environmental process is through. They're doing that in a fashion that's fast, what they call fast-tracking. They say that so that they can build the road faster and meet the needs quicker, but it certainly is fraught with opportunities to shortcut the process. And those things are all happening with a lot of assistance from the federal government. And one of the things that's pretty interesting is this is seen as not just a state project internationally. We follow the foreign trade as well, and there's a magazine that's printed in Spain, Expansion magazine, and there is a story that appeared 2 years ago about on the Trans-Texas Corridor, and the photograph that accompanied it, strangely enough, wasn't one of the current Texas officials. It was, in fact, the President of the United States, as you know, a Texan.
Yes.
And so they certainly draw parallels, and they were talking about all the money that was to be made in Texas with the Trans-Texas Corridor. So it is larger than just a state issue. It's a national and international issue.
This doesn't make any sense to me. As you know, NAFTA has proven itself. Well, in your opinion, what has NAFTA proven itself to you?
Well, NAFTA hasn't proven anything to me, and I'd be quite honest with you, I'm not heavily involved in pro or con on NAFTA. I'm interested in real issues that affect real people here in Texas who are trying to make a living and to live their lives. I don't see NAFTA providing anything significant there. You know, the truck traffic that comes through, great. But, you know, most of that traffic is not going out of Texas. The the port of Laredo is the busiest inland port in North America, and that's tractor-trailer trucks. And just a few months ago, a gentleman from the port of Laredo was testifying before the House Transportation Committee here in Texas, and he was telling them how something in the range of 80% of all the trucks that come into the United States at Laredo destinate in Texas. So this is not exactly international trade. These are not trucks making a beeline for the Canadian border so they can move goods to and from Canada. The fact of the matter is those trucks are going here in Texas, and they'd be going in here with or without a NAFTA highway. So I'm a little bit baffled as to why we need to have an international NAFTA project when we've already got the commerce and trade that it would theoretically produce.
Now, there's the crux of the situation. It's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to be a 50-year project to the tune of, I've heard $184 billion. I've heard even more billions of dollars in a public-private partnership. And yet, you've got this high-speed rail. You've got cargo rail. You've got low-speed rail. You have toll roads in this. I'm sure most of these highways are going to be toll roads, are they?
All of them are going to be toll, yes.
They're all going to be toll roads. We're going to have to pay to drive. What are they planning on doing with the interstate highways now?
Well, that's a good question. As a matter of fact, the chairman of the Transportation Commission said he thinks it's perfectly reasonable for the state to negotiate an agreement with the franchise operator of these new toll roads to have a non-compete clause to limit the amount that we can expand the existing interstate highways. Not a problem, he says, because he's going to allow, this would allow 35 to be expanded another lane in each direction. Well, we are again talking about 50 to 70 years, and when you look at the growth and the expansion, adding an additional lane now, great. But, Sintra's not looking at this as a 10-year or 15 or 20-year project. This is a 50 or 70-year project, really at the minimum. There's nothing that says that when they're 10 years into it, they can't extend for another 50 years. The law's written in such a way they're limited to a 70-year agreement, but there's nothing to say they can't renew that every 10 years and it just goes on forever. So when they're looking at it, yeah, you're exactly right. When the free alternatives become so choked and our large cities are strangled, we'll have no alternative but to use these high-priced toll roads and pay this foreign operator to use what should be public infrastructure. And we consider freedom of movement as one of our basic freedoms in this country. And what we're going to find is there's going to be an economic barrier to the freedom of movement. We're going to find we have classes of people. We have those who can afford to move around and those who can't.
Now that we see that this is a multi-year or a multi-decade plan, and we're learning about Agenda 21, those of us that do, we're seeing that they want to eliminate our ability to drive in the future. Could this be a direction to move us into rapid transit transportation and get us out of our automobiles?
In Texas in particular, if they don't force that, it's not going to happen. There isn't any scenario in which rail is efficiently effective in Texas. Our density is too low, and there's no reasonably good public transportation at any destination points. The high-speed rail was proposed here in the late 80s and early 90s, and moved forward. LTV, I believe it was working on the high-speed rail. And one of the companies that came out and fought real hard against it was Southwest Airlines, because they saw the high-speed rail competing with their regional airline operation. It's pretty interesting that as the Trans-Texas Corridor has unfolded, you don't see Southwest Airlines or anyone else raising that same objection, and for a very simple reason. It's because it won't work. The Trans-Texas Corridor does not go to those destinations, and by not going to those destinations, it can't compete with regional airlines. And so, if you have to take a commuter rail out to the high-speed rail, get on the high-speed rail and take it to a point where you get off and make another transfer to commuter rail to go back into the city, your plane would have already landed and you'd be off of it. The other thing that baffles us is Homeland Security. We live in a different time, day and age, with terrorist threats. you're going to put all your infrastructure into what then becomes very narrow, well-defined structures. Put six rail lines, four truck lanes, eight car lanes, six vehicle lanes, underground utilities, overhead utilities. What a nice, neat package that is. You know, when you do planning for hardening against terrorists, you do vulnerability assessments, and you take all your vulnerabilities and you spread them out. You don't concentrate them all into one place and build overpasses over them so that there's convenient from the top access. Airlines, you know, only have to be protected when they're on the ground. Once you can get above a minimum altitude, those flights are relatively safe. And what's more is even if a terrorist does have an impact on a plane, it doesn't disrupt your public transportation. There's another plane and another plane and another plane. But, you know, you can be missing just 2 feet of rail out of a 4,000-mile set of track, and that 2 feet is going to cause you a big problem, and it's going to be a big disruption. And when you start disrupting transportation, you start disrupting economies, and you start disrupting other things, and it has a huge ripple effect. So why we would even consider something that has the vulnerabilities of this is mind-boggling.
Well, it hasn't been considered. It's in the implementation in the planning stages, correct?
Yes, it certainly is.
And these are smart highways, supposedly?
Yes, they are.
Highly regulated, and yet you have a 200-foot utility zone for large underground water lines, natural gas and petroleum pipelines, telecommunication cables, overhead high-voltage electric transmission lines. It looks like they're trying to consolidate everything into these corridors.
Yeah, it's a little bit of trying to be all things to all people, and I'm not certain how much of that they really think is reality and how much of that is just window dressing to get various interests to throw in and be interested in it. Because certainly the economics aren't there for really any of those elements that we can tell. We don't even see a feasibility study that says that people will pay a $62 toll to drive from outside San Antonio to outside Dallas where they're building the first 316-mile segment.
Wow, isn't that expensive?
So right now we pay 20 cents per gallon in state gasoline tax and 18.4 in federal. So that's not very much, really, in the big scheme of things. If you were to take the tolls that are being proposed for this toll road, you'd be paying the equivalent of $3.85 a gallon. That is a big number.
And it could get larger, couldn't it?
Yes, it could. It's also, this flies in the face of what's happening with the world's energy sources. At this particular juncture, making massive investments, $184 billion in old technology transportation doesn't seem to be very cutting edge.
So major land acquisition is going to be required for this, and you're certainly on the same wavelength that the rest of us are, that this latest ruling by the Supreme Court connects to taking away property and for the corridors that are being implemented. Now, are you in touch with anyone in the country that has the same concern you have in their part of the country?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we work with a group in Indiana. We've also worked with a group in Washington State. Washington State had the closest project to this. It was called the Washington Commerce Corridor that was going to run from Oregon to Canada. And interestingly enough, how clever the state of Washington, they did a feasibility study and then canceled the project. You imagine Texas doing a feasibility study before we launched this $184 billion boondoggle?
Well, it would be logical to do that, wouldn't it?
Well, it just depends on your perspective. If you're interested in a sincere, transportation-oriented public works project, yeah, you probably would do that. But if there's someone there that's interested in turning a buck, whether it's legitimate or illegitimate, be it through a private... You know, you called this a public-private partnership a minute ago, and I'd like to clarify that what you really have is a government-imposed monopoly. This is not really the kind of open free market participation that they would have you would like for you to believe. This is really another monopoly. And at a time when we've gotten away from monopolies in telephone and electric, we're going to turn around and create a transportation monopoly. So someone needs to explain that one to me. But yes, we are working with groups all across the country that are having similar issues and problems, Colorado, Kentucky, And, you know, it's a property rights issue. It's a freedom of movement issue. It's a toll issue. It's just a big problem. And they have this particular toll road operator has come under a lot of criticism for a toll road that they operate in Canada. It's very expensive, and they use, not only did they get a 99-year concession to operate 407 ETR in Canada, but they're using the state's power to enforce the collection of tolls. And as a matter of fact, if you owe the toll company, now this is a private toll company, if you owe this private toll company money, they're now working to keep you from getting registration for your vehicle or perhaps even a driver's license, so that the government power is used to collect a private debt, which we also have a big issue with.
Bill, one of my friends and researchers, has stated that it's not public-private partnership, although we're led to believe that, and that's UN logo, public-private partnership. He says it's public-commercial partnership. A commercial corporation isn't private. It exists by permission of the respective state, and IRS and Securities Exchange Commission is what he says. As we look at this, and people are stating that it's going to be creating more jobs for us, this is the best thing that we can do, is create more jobs for us, but yet we've got foreign entities coming into this country to build the highways.
Yes, and I'm certain that they will use a majority of domestic labor. But you know, all of the cost that's being spent on it isn't going to a paycheck. If that's the case, we'd do much better and it'd be much more efficient just to pick out how many people you want to send a check to and send them a check and save us all the other grief, not take people's property away and not build a project that will never be fully utilized. We're in the land here of the super collider. You know, an awful lot of land was lost to the federal government to do a super collider project here in Texas, and they never finished the collider, and those people have lost their land forever.
Now, what was that, the super collider?
The super collider was a science project, actually. It was to build a proton accelerator that is in a giant loop. It's a big circular underground facility that does atomic research. And they got into this project, and it's kind of like the Big Dig in Boston. You underestimate the cost of the project until you have commitment. And then the costs can grow exponentially, and people are into it. But the federal government got out of it. And when they got out of it, they abandoned the project, and everything was sold off except for the land. And now we have big holdings of government property that used to one day be private property. One of the things in the plan for the Trans-Texas Corridor is it says to, as quickly as possible, purchase or take all 184,000 acres. They want to acquire the land as quickly as possible so they have the land. They don't really have to build anything on it because the new law allows them to lease it. So they go right into the land development and landlord business, taking away private land so that they can turn around and lease it and again, generate revenue for the state.
Where do you think all these residences are going to move to?
Well, that's a good question. And as my wife would point out, the residences really are the least of the problem. But if you were to look at your Agenda 21, they're going to go to the big cities. We're going to depopulate the rural countryside. And whether you buy into that project concept or not, that's what's going to happen. But as my wife would point out, in rural Texas, you have people who have for generations made their living with the land. That is their job. They raise cattle or they farm. And you can't go get the classified ads and look for a 1,000-acre farm with fertile soil so that you can continue your occupation. When you lose your land, you not only lose your land and your home, but you lose your job. You lose your ability to make a livelihood, and you're going to have to go do something else. And that's wrong also.
I see, according to the Associated Press, the House today approved by 231-189 vote a bid by conservative Scott Garrett, Republican of New Jersey, to bar federal transportation funds from being used to make improvements on lands seized via eminent domain for private development. It says the legislation in the works also would ban the use of federal funds for any project getting the go-ahead using the Kelo versus City of New London decision. Obviously, people are pretty upset in this country regarding this decision. I don't know where it's going to take us. What do you think?
Well, I hope that it wakes some people up. There's an awful lot of apathy. There are people who think that your responsibility in the government begins and ends in the ballot box, and that's not true. We need to pay attention, to take responsibility for our government, to make sure that it's being responsive and doing what we expect it to do. If we don't, then it won't. And we'll find that we no longer are in control of the government. The government's in control of us.
Are you going to put a link section in your site so we can connect to these other people in the rest of the country that are upset about their NAFTA corridor?
Yes. As a matter of fact, some of those are already on the site today. If you, you'll see there's a red bar that says news and links, and it has internet links, and there are a list of other opposition groups for corridor projects that are listed on that page. There's the Texas opposition group sites, and then there's also other non-Texas opposition group sites. And, you know, there's Axe the Tax in Florida, and we talked about the Washington Commerce Corridor. There's an opposition group there called Can the Corridor in Indiana, and New Jersey as well. New Jersey has got a big backlash on tolls. And when you talk about tolls, that's a good point to bring up, too. The Trans-Texas Corridor is projecting the tolls for passenger cars will run between 15 and 20 cents a mile. And I got to tell you that number seems extremely inflated. In Pennsylvania, they raised the toll for the second time in a year last year, and there was a huge outcry. And their new toll was 5.9 cents a mile. 5.9 cents. That made them higher than the Ohio Turnpike, the New Jersey Turnpike, the Garden State Turnpike. You know, the New Jersey Turnpike's 5 cents a mile, and we're talking about three times that in Texas. Where is all the extra money going? You can't tell me that building and operating toll roads in Texas is three times more expensive than in those states that have much more severe weather conditions. It just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense, and this is the concern that I have about what's going on in our country most of my life. Most things haven't made much sense to me, the way our federal government runs things, and certainly the fact that we have one vote in the U.N. system with 50 sovereign states, and it seems like the regionalism of our country has abandoned our states, and the federal government doles out money to the states for education, and yet our children aren't being educated properly, it appears. Do you see some ulterior motives that are being directed here to implement the directions that are going to be the call for our doom here?
You know, I'm not real sure what the...
I mean, these are intelligent people. You're associated with intelligent people, and yet this NAFTA corridor or these highways to an intelligent person doesn't make sense, does it?
Well, to someone it must make sense, but it certainly doesn't to me. I think there are a lot of people have been sold a bill of goods. You know, there are transportation people who have been told they can build their way out of congestion, and yet the real transportation experts, if you just ask them, and if you look at empirical evidence across the entire country, you can't build your way out of congestion. When you add more lanes, that creates more capacity. People will fill that capacity, and you create even greater congestion. I'm not sure who they're listening to. You know, we have in Texas, all of our statewide office holders are Republicans. And if you look at the official party platform for the state of Texas, the Republican Party of Texas, you'll find in there is a heading that says Trans-Texas Corridor, and it reads just two sentences. It says, because there are issues of confiscation of private land, state and national sovereignty, and other similar concerns, the party urges the repeal of 3588 authorizing the Trans-Texas Corridor. We further urge the removal of all authorization and power granted the Texas Transportation Commission and the Texas Department of Transportation for the construction and operation of the Trans-Texas Corridor. Those are the very things we've just been talking about, confiscation of private land. I mean, the Republican Party saw that in June of last year, a year ago. National sovereignty, state sovereignty, they saw that a year ago. And yet the leadership is not paying attention to the grassroots that represent the party for which they are supposed to be elected by and support and represent. So I'm not sure who's calling the tunes.
Well, there you have it. And certainly thanks to your website, here we see the World Bank Group, toll roads and concessions.
Yes.
The World Bank Group is the UN system.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the Trans-Texas Corridor is modeled on the same type of toll road concession project you'll find in Malaysia and Hungary and third world countries that have no economy, where the government cannot underwrite infrastructure. And why the state of Texas needs to go to a third world system of financing highways is well beyond me.
Well, apparently this is all designed for this global economy that's being developed at the World Trade Organization, and this is where the strength in numbers is going to make a gigantic difference. And you're creating an inroad with your information and your people that you're working with in your local area, being that you've had these meetings. Is there a lot of camaraderie about this now?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there are communities all over Texas that are forming their own chapters of organizations to address these issues and oppose the corridor. Blackland Coalition is organizing chapters in rural parts of Texas. We have anti-toll groups now that have formed in Austin, in Dallas, in Houston. It's really starting to get out there. People are starting to get the picture, and we think there's going to be a huge backlash, and we certainly hope there is, because this is something that needs to be turned around.
Oh, it has to be turned around. We have no choice but to draw the line here, as they're about to vote on CAFTA and more FTAA. But certainly these Texas opposition groups in your side is very beneficial here. And my goodness gracious, you've both done, you and your wife have done some tremendous work on this website. I'm just most impressed. And at this stage of this situation, what would you recommend to the listeners right now?
Well, what listeners need to do right now is to contact their state and national representatives and senators and tell them that they demand that they protect their property rights. We need some legislation in place right now. It will help with the Trans-Texas Corridor. It will help with countless other affronts of private property rights to put into place legislation that stops the taking of private land for the generation of government revenue. There is a resolution that's been introduced in the Texas House, and there's a concurrent resolution out of the Senate now, but they won't even get to vote on that if the governor doesn't put it on the call for this special session. So we need to have people contact the governor's office and tell the governor that they want this addressed, and they want it addressed during this special session, not to wait. And then our legislators can do the rest, but we got to have that part happening.
David, I sure appreciate your time. Thank you very much. I hope to speak to you in the very near future. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My privilege. And that was an interview that will be recorded and played back in the future by all of you, I hope. Darren Weeks tomorrow night, listeners. Darren does tremendous research and information. Continue to listen, and God bless you all.
Record budget deficits, bankruptcies galore, and the U.S. dollar is at an all-time low. With today's gloomy economic outlook, safe investments are often hard to find. For over a decade, Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company has been helping people secure their future by investing in the precious metals. Melody has the honesty, integrity, and experience that is often lacking in the precious metals business. Let her put it to work for you. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.